answer the question on whatever the heck bill it was.
2520.
As far as does this change the audit requirement under property tax law?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Holly Robinson from Legislative Council. The answer most directly is no. The provisions of 2520 solely create new budgeting procedures for a local health district, which only deals with the issue of developing a budget, publishing it, and having it passed. It will have no impact on any of the property tax requirements imposed on local health districts.
Okay. Any other questions? Thank you very much, Holly.
My pleasure.
Okay, with that, we don't have a quorum for a vote on that bill, so I will not go into work session, but I will go into a public hearing on House Bill 3040. The long wait is over. We are here. Diane.
Well, Chair Cruz and members of the committee, House Bill 3040 is a patient protection bill. During the interim, a group of people came together to speak on patient protection and patient rights. It was actually a governor's work group. The work group came up with 5 points of agreement. Some people are here to speak to it today. I'm not as familiar with this bill, to tell you the truth. As I would like to be.
Committee, that you need to know that this is a product of a work group. It's a consensus product, and we've got folks here that are going to talk about aspects.
I believe this is a panel of folks that we need to get
first. Okay. Panel one, Tim Nesbitt, Lisa Trussell, and Deb Seifert.
Good afternoon, Chair Cruz, members of the committee. You called me first, so I'll assume I'm starting off. I'm Tim Nesbitt, president of the Oregon AFL-CIO, appearing in support of House Bill 3040, which we can proudly call our own Patient's Bill of Rights. With us in support of this bill, as you'll hear, are employers as well as labor unions, health insurers and consumers, Democrats and Republicans. As you said, this is a consensus bill. And it was a long time in coming. 2 years ago, I would have said that reaching a consensus on this issue was improbable, if not impossible. A bill with similar provisions never even got a hearing in the last session of the legislature. And if you remember 2 years ago, there was a popular film called As Good as It Gets, which managed to get cheers from theater crowds with four-letter expletives about the quality of care in HMOs. So we were in an environment of great cynicism and criticism about healthcare delivery and HMOs. And in conjunction with consumer groups, we added our name to 6 separate ballot proposals, patient protection ballot draft initiatives for the 2000 election. But what followed that process is proof that a good faith, deliberative effort can produce a better and more certain outcome than a straight ahead campaign for a yes or no vote on a single ballot proposal. In response to requests from several health insurers and at the invitation of Governor Kitzhaber and with the support of DCBS staff, we and our partners in the Oregon Health Action Campaign agreed to set aside the initiatives and tackle the proposals contained in those proposals one by one, looking at need, cost, and administrative feasibility. Our work group included representatives of the AFL-CIO, the Oregon Health Action Campaign, Campaign for Patients' Rights, ODS Health Plan, Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield, Providence Health Plan, Kaiser Permanente, HIPAA-CARE, AOI, the Oregon Healthcare Purchases Coalition, and the Public Employees Benefit Board. And in addition, we received significant staff assistance from DCBS and from the governor's office. Our group met 12 times between May and November, with another 9 subcommittee meetings through the end of the year. It was time-consuming, sometimes contentious, but it worked. And it worked because we got the common interest in balancing the quality and adequacy of our healthcare system with what could be shown to be cost-effective for consumers and administratively feasible for insurers. And it worked because we're all mindful of the political reality that the public wants guarantees and safeguards when it comes to the provision of health care, especially in managed care settings. So in the end, we reached agreement on 5 of the 6 issues that we put on the table, and they are external review, continuity of care, ongoing referrals to specialists, network adequacy, and the right to sue. Consumers and labor didn't get everything we sought on these issues, but we did reach agreement. And the 6th issue involved a proposal for a standardized exception process for prescription drug formularies in the commercial market. On this issue, we agreed not to pursue any change in current law. So it's important to note that in all of these issues, we agreed to a single package of proposals, now House Bill 3040. And further, as part of our ground rules and our final agreement, we agreed to support these and only these proposals on these issues. Finally, we agreed not to support any other proposals on these issues. So in effect, our consensus is tied to the delegate balance we constructed and we achieved in this package. With these understandings, our executive board voted unanimously last December 1st to support this package, and HB 3040, with some minor technical amendments that I think you have before you, will codify that package of reforms. These reforms, to sum up, are what healthcare consumers want and deserve, and what we want to see as a minimum for our members and their families in the health plans that we negotiate. We believe these reforms are affordable and cost-effective, and we hope they'll contribute to rebuilding consumer confidence in HMOs and PPOs so that they can continue to be cost-effective and appropriate mechanisms for the delivery of high-quality care in our state. Politically, we believe House Bill 3040 is a win-win proposal for us, for you, and for all consumers in Oregon. We worked hard to construct it for you, and we hope it makes your job easier this session than it was last session in getting to a resolution on these issues. Thank you.
Thank you. Have you seen the dash twos? I mean, there's a couple of really sticky things, and you're fine.
The dash twos are perfect solution to the technical.
Chair, members of the committee, I hand engrossed the dash one amendments into the bill, and there are a couple small changes. The dash twos added to this.
It's a change of an A to B, that sort of thing.
Word changes, but not substitute changes. So your handed gross bill with the dash one should
be basically
give you the full and substantive intent of the amendment.
Lisa?
Actually, I think. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Deborah Seifert. I'm the Assistant Vice President for Health Policy and Government Affairs for Regents of La Crosse Officials of Oregon. I'm here testifying today in favor of the proposal before you. Regents was very pleased with the process by which interested parties came together to work on this proposal and these issues, and we're also pleased with the product that resulted from this process. We believe that the proposal sets forth a number of appropriate consumer protections that build upon the legislation that was passed in 1997, actually the second year of patient protections here in the state of Oregon. We also don't believe that this proposal would add significant costs for health benefit plans in the state. And I say that for two reasons. First of all, a number of plans, Regents and other plans in this market, have already moved forward with a number of these proposals. For example, Regents has already moved forward in the last year to put in place an external review process for consumers. The second reason why I say that I don't believe it will be significant cost increase for health benefit plans is that the provisions in front of you, though administrative or operative or operational in nature, they are not heavy on the administrative side as far as tracking documentation and filing of information. With that, I know there are additional people testifying after me that are getting into the specifics of the bill, so I'll end there, but I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Lisa?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Lisa Trussell, and I'm with Associated Oregon Industries, and we're here today in support of House Bill 3040. And my part of the presentation today is just to briefly go through the five key components and just summarize what they do, and then others behind us will talk in more detail about them. The first area, one of the areas the bill addresses, is external review. And we've agreed to an external review process for disputes involving medical necessity and experimental procedures. They'll be conducted by independent review organizations that contract through the Department of Consumer and Business Services. The decisions would be binding on both parties in most cases and would include the right to sue a health plan in the limited circumstances described in the right to sue section. Continuity of care is addressed. The group agreed that a consumer undergoing a course of treatment would be entitled to continued care from their treating provider under certain circumstances for up to 120 days when the provider has left the consumer's managed care network. Referrals to specialists, we've agreed to require health care plans to have procedures for standing referrals to specialists and to give consumers a right to a second opinion regarding the need for a referral. Network adequacy is addressed by the group. We agreed that DCBS will convene an advisory group to assist in the development of administrative rules providing for uniform indicators that HMOs and other network plans would use to report the scope and adequacy of their provider networks. The group agreed that it would be an unfair trade practice to materially misrepresent certain aspects of their networks. And lastly is the right to sue provision. We agreed to a limited right to sue relating to compliance with an external review decision. The right would apply only when a health plan chooses to offer non-binding external review and subsequently refuses to comply with the external review decision in a specific case. Health plans agreeing to be bound by external review decisions would not be subject to any new legal exposure, but would be subject to fines for failing to comply with their contracts. And in closing, I'd just like to say AOI urges your support of House Bill 3040.
Any questions for this panel? Thank you very much. Senators Metzger and Corcoran.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Kirk Metzger, State Senator, District 14. I'm here to testify in support of HB 3040 and also to tell you how pleased I am here today. To thank the Chair for his leadership in being the principal sponsor of this bill, Ms. Anderson, Mr. Orsett, and others. HB 3040 provides many protections for Oregonians enrolled in managed care. I've sponsored similar legislation for two sessions now, and I'm pleased to see that through your leadership a compromise bill has been created, and to be a co-sponsor of that legislation myself. I thank the members of the work group, the insurers, labor, and healthcare consumers for their hard work and commitment to this issue. The protections provided by HB 3040 are especially important to Oregon because we are continually one of the top five states when it comes to the amount of people enrolled in managed care. And according to the National Council of State Legislatures, 42% of Oregonians are currently enrolled in managed care. HB 3040 provides several protections for Oregonians enrolled, but I'd like to take a moment to comment on two of those protections that were just mentioned that I think are very critical: external review and protecting a patient's continuity of care. External review, the protection is already provided in 40 states. This would allow individuals who are enrolled in an HMO plan to appeal a plan's adverse decision to an independent review board. It allows consumers to appeal to an independent third party a denied test, treatment, or other service. Second, the continuity of care provision provides what is already provided in 32 other states. The continuity of care from the medical perspective is one of the most important factors related to the promotion of health and the prevention of disease. The ongoing relationship between healthcare providers and patients allows for a more complete picture of an individual's healthcare needs. This bill allows enrollees the opportunity to continue to obtain treatment from their healthcare provider for up to 120 days after the healthcare provider has left the HMO. Let me give you an example. If a patient is in the midst of a chemotherapy treatment for cancer and his doctor leaves the HMO, there could be significant emotional and physical trauma for the patient if that care was interrupted by having to switch doctors. I'm pleased that we're putting patients first and giving them the protections they deserve. HB 3040 is based on the belief that key decisions on health care should be made by patients and their health care provider. The bill is good for Oregon. I appreciate your support, Mr. Chair, and all the people that worked on this so very, very hard. And I just wanted to add my support to that as well. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, happy almost St. Patty's Day. Mr. Chair, I have 17 pages of prepared testimony that I'm not going to read. No, I'm just kidding, Mr. Chair. It's late in the afternoon. I basically would like to say the following things. Number one, this is my fourth session in the legislature, and I really want to honor your leadership in moving a bill forward after four sessions of attempts to get something like this passed. I think it really speaks volumes to the level of work together, bipartisan work together that's been done on this issue and a lot of issues in the building this time, kumbaya aside. So the fact that this bill has, by my count, and I'm Irish, four of the members of this committee signed on as sponsors, I think it probably has a very good chance of passing. So with that, I just want to acknowledge your leadership, acknowledge AOI and the AFL-CIO and the insurance companies even for their good work on this measure. Thank you very much.
Senator, I think this thing is greased.
Thank you, buddy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much.
Well, if there's any questions, because Representative Tomei doesn't like me.
Put that on the record, please.
I think that was, actually.
Mr. Chair, I'm just wondering, is this the part where we get up and all join hands and form a circle?
Yes.
Well, if it wasn't 4:30, we might. Panel two, Lynn Marie, Ed, and Joe.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Joel Lario. I'm the insurance administrator with the Department of Consumer and Business Services. It was our pleasure to facilitate the discussions that took place on this bill, and we're very proud of the bill and very proud of the groups that came together to make this bill happen. I'll just make two brief comments and then turn it over to the real experts on the bill. The two comments are, one, these are very tough issues, and I think it's the groups are really to be commended for coming together and working out these tough issues. And number two is that once they were worked out conceptually, as those of us who have been involved in the legislative process know, it's a real trick to move from that to actual legislative language. The two people who did that work are seated with me here, and that's Ed Niebert and Lynn Marie Kreider, and I will now turn it over to them to talk about the specifics of the bill.
Ed, would you, for the committee, could you wish your wife happy birthday?
Oh, thank you. That news got to you? Good. I am watching the clock a little, but we have enough time. Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Ed Niebert. I'm the Director of Regulatory Affairs for Providence Health Plan, and we were one of the participants in this consensus process. I'm going to go through about the first half of the bill, hitting some of the what I would call more detailed highlights, but I'm going to try to keep it at the highlights level, and then I'll turn it over to Lynn Marie, who will hit the second half of the bill. So starting from the front, the first section actually builds on some definitions that are already in law from the 1997 Patient Protection Act. And the significant issues in that first section are, we modify a current definition of managed health insurance, and we add a new definition of preferred provider insurance. And I'll try to put this in the vernacular, managed health insurance in the current and in the revised definition is meant to address closed network health plans such as an HMO. So if you've got a plan that says you have to stay within a certain network, that's what the bill means by managed health insurance. And then we added a definition for preferred provider organization because those are common plans that also use a network of providers, but they don't use the network in the same way. You have more ability to go out of the network, and so we wanted to make that distinction. But I want to point out that in most of the sections of the bill, the patient protections apply both to managed health insurance, or HMO, if you will, and to preferred provider, or PPO. I want to point out one other thing since we're talking about who the bill applies to. Like all state insurance regulations, these proposals would address state licensed insurance companies and the citizens that they cover. They would not address anybody who is covered by a self-insured benefit plan because they're subject only to federal regulation. And self-insured benefit plans cover a significant chunk of Oregon citizens, perhaps 20% of the folks who have health insurance coverage in the state. So state law can never get at everybody with health insurance coverage, but it gets at a pretty good chunk. I also want to point out that these patient protections would not apply to what I would call traditional indemnity type insurance plans that don't have a network provision, that don't require you or compel you to use certain providers. So this really does deal with what the press and the public thinks about as managed care health insurance. The first substantive section, then section three, is continuity of care. And this addresses the issue that when you're in a network health plan, what happens if your treating physician leaves the plan? Under the plan, you may not be able to get coverage to see that physician, or you might get reduced coverage. So the consensus agreement was that if your treating physician leaves your network plan and you're in an active course of treatment, that you're being treated for something that needs ongoing treatment, that you would have rights to continue that course of treatment for a limited period of time. And again, I want to point out a detail that this applies when a member's physician leaves the plan. It doesn't apply when the member leaves the plan or when the member's group drops their plan. There's other provisions in state law for what happens when you lose your coverage. In this instance, you haven't lost your coverage. You've lost your physician. And so this gives you some continuity with your physician. And in general, it provides 120 days of continued care, again, if you're in an active course of treatment and your physician has left the plan. And there's a slightly modified set of continuity provisions for women who are pregnant, and it's the later of 6 weeks after delivery or the 120 days. So both cases are addressed. Then Section 4 leads into Section 5, which again builds upon existing law. And what it simply does is say that these continuity of care provisions must be put into the contract between a health insurer and a provider, so that continuity of care becomes a mutual responsibility of the health plan and the provider who might have to provide the continuity when that physician leaves the plan. So there's already law on those contracts, and this provision builds on those provisions regarding continuity. The next provision, Section 5, is also, if you will, sort of a continuity provision. It carries the heading referrals to specialists, but it deals with plans that have what are called gatekeeper provisions, where your primary care comes from a gatekeeper primary care physician, and to get specialty care, you have to get a referral from that primary physician. In some cases, it's perceived that getting those referrals can be burdensome, difficult, time-consuming. And so what this provision would say is that if a patient needs regular treatment by a specialist and their primary care physician agrees that they do need that, then they can get what's called a standing referral for specialty care. You don't have to get a referral every time. You get sort of a blanket referral to continue to get your specialty care. And then one other related aspect, once in a while, a member in a plan will say, well, gee, I've talked to my primary care physician about getting a referral, and my physician says, no, I don't think you need one. well, gee, I think I need one. And so if the member and the physician disagree about the need for a referral, the provision would say that the member could get a second opinion on that need for a referral. So with that, I'll turn it over to Lynn Marie for the other sections of the bill.
Yeah, that's in the mess up. I changed doctors because of that situation. Now, where do you get a second independent? Do you have to go to a different clinic to get a second opinion, not another doctor in that clinic? Is that right?
Mr. Chair, Representative Morissette, what the bill says is that you can get a second opinion from another primary care physician in the plan, not necessarily in the very same clinic, but in the plan. And if the plan doesn't have a physician available to render that opinion, then they would have to allow you to even go out of the plan to get the second opinion.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Lynn Marie Kreider, the research director at the Oregon AFL-CIO, and Ed and I did spend a great deal of time trying to make sure that we had language here that the whole group was comfortable with to implement their policy decisions. And I'll start with the network adequacy sections of the bill that are on page 6 of the bill, section 6. The network adequacy provisions do not guarantee that networks will be adequate in any objective sense. What they try to do is to provide consumers with better information to evaluate networks of various competing plans so that they can make good choices in selecting plans. So Section 6 applies to managed care organizations and preferred provider organizations as we've defined them in the bill. Again, we're building on current law, which requires managed care organizations to report annually on the scope of their networks and their efforts to make services available to enrollees in the plan. What current law doesn't do is require that there be any uniformity in how those reports are made. And so what Section 6 does is say that number one, the covered plans will be required to report the scope of the plan and the adequacy of the network, and they will do it in terms of uniform indicators that will be prescribed by the director. Now, that is not an easy task, and we recognize that. And so the bill requires the director to convene a group of folks like consumers, purchasers, and insurers to assist in developing those uniform indicators that the plans would then use to report on their networks. Section 7 of the bill also is trying to address questions of information to consumers with regard to networks. Most of the boldface type that you see in Section 7 is simply changes in form and style. The substantive change is at page 7, lines 35 through 37, which adds a new unfair practice to the insurance code, saying that if anyone misrepresents the provider network of an insurer of a managed care insurance or preferred provider insurance, including its composition or the availability of providers to enrollees, then they can be penalized for providing that unfair, that inaccurate information. An example would be an insurance broker or agent that said, or materials from an insurer that said, we've got providers that can provide the whole range of services within our network. But in fact, they don't. They don't have cardiologists in their network. Well, that's a material misrepresentation of the network and could give rise to penalties. Simply a consumer protection piece. The external review sections begin on page 7 of the bill, and these actually apply beyond managed care organizations. They apply to essentially all of the health insurance that the department regulates. So it includes indemnity plans. Its coverage is coextensive with the existing requirements that health plans have grievance procedures. And this is sort of a final step of the grievance procedure. Sections 8, 9, 10, 11, and 12 prescribe that system. And the requirement is that all of these plans allow for external review, independent review of decisions about whether a covered service is medically necessary. So if a plan denies a service on the basis that it's not medically necessary in the particular case, or denies a service on the ground that it's experimental or investigational, or finally, if there is a dispute over whether a patient is entitled to the protections of the continuity of care piece of the bill, and the basis of that dispute is the insurer says you're not in an active course of treatment, so you can't continue with your provider. You need to find another provider within the plan. So if the question is the patient or is the patient not in an active course of treatment, then that dispute also could go to an external reviewer. Sections 8 and 10 explain the insurer's responsibilities in the process. 9 addresses the functions of BCBS. Section 11 deals with the responsibilities of the enrollee, and Section 12, the responsibilities of the independent review organization. But basically, looking at it sequentially, the system works like this. The enrollee first needs to use the grievance procedure that's required of insurers. And if there's an adverse decision at the last step of that grievance procedure, then the enrollee can make a written request for independent review, if the dispute is one of the three kinds that I outlined before. The insurer is then responsible for going to DCBS saying, we've got a dispute on our hands. Who should we take it to? The DCBS will have responsibility for entering into contracts with up to 5 independent review organizations. Now, those organizations are designed to have a lot of experts in different fields on their available to them, so that they one of the things that DCBS will be doing, presumably, in deciding who to contract with is looking at the quality of the panels available to the review organization. In any event, DCBS assigns a review organization at random from among those that it has selected and contracted with. So unlike the current voluntary systems for external review, this process takes the decision of who the reviewer is out of the hands of the insurance company and puts it into a random process. The insurer then forwards the records of the case to the IRO, which in turn sends it out to the appropriate experts within their organization. The review organization also receives information submitted by the enrollee, if the enrollee has material to add. And the IRO then must make a decision within timelines prescribed by the bill, which is 30 days in an ordinary case and 3 days in an emergency case. Or the bill actually calls it an expedited case, I believe. The decision about whether a case should be expedited is essentially in the hands of the treating physician. That is, if the treating physician says and backs it up with documentation that there will be harm to the patient if review is delayed, then this expedited timeline falls into place. So the actual standard for that expedited process is at, where is it, page 8, line 16 to 20 of the bill. The review organization is required in making the decision to exercise its own judgment in view of the medical evidence and medical standards in the country. The review organization cannot, however, require the insurer to provide something that's not covered by the plan. So we're looking at what are the covered services, and within that, is it medically necessary in the particular case, or is it experimental in the particular case, or is continuity required in the particular case? The fees for this process are paid by the insurer. And finally, the bill provides for making public the decision while protecting, of course, any information that would allow you to identify the patient. But the notion there is that we ought to be able to build some common understandings within the state about what is experimental, what is medically necessary, and so on, recognizing that that will evolve over time. Sections 10, 13, and 14 address the effects of independent review decisions. As Lisa Trussell noted, in most cases we expect that the decision of the independent reviewer will be binding on the health plan and on the enrollee. But we have to deal with some realities in terms of our constitutional system in the state of Oregon. And because of that, we have developed a system whereby the insurer, in writing the plan, says either we will or we will not agree to be bound by decisions of an IRO. If they say that they will agree to be bound, then the enrollee also makes a similar agreement by enrolling in the plan. Let's see. Section 13 of the bill then says, in that circumstances where the parties have agreed to be bound by the decision of an IRO, then if, in fact, the health plan fails to abide by that decision, DCBS shall impose a penalty for failure to do that. And it's a very heavy penalty, between $100,000 and $1 million. On the other hand, if the insurer says in its plan, we're not going to be bound by decisions of an IRO, then they will nonetheless have to go through the process and there will be a decision out there, but they don't have to follow it. But the consequences in that situation, if the health plan refuses to follow the decision of an IRO, is that there is a right to sue the health plan created by this bill. And in that situation, the enrollee could bring a lawsuit. Okay. The court would decide whether or not, or the jury in that kind of case, would decide whether or not the plan had wronged the enrollee. The decision of the IRO would be evidence, but wouldn't control that decision. And the damages would be whatever harm was caused to the enrollee by the adverse decision. So that is the limited and way in which this bill creates a right to sue patients and health plans. The dash two amendments, you will note.
Excuse me, Representative Morissette. I guess that raises in my mind the question of, I understand if a company doesn't agree to the plan, that will have some negative impact on its image. But how are we going to get word out to the general public that there has been a fairly monumental change in
in this? I mean, are we going to... Because individual companies might bury some of this information, and I'm wondering how consumers are going to be made aware.
The bill does require that in the... Help me, Ed, if you recall exactly where this is. But Section 15 of the law is the existing language that describes what an insurer has to say in its policy. And among the things that it must state in the bill as amended is on page 13 at line 29 through 31, the insurer must explain the external review process, and then further down at lines 43 and on to the next page, the insurer has to notify the enrollee whether they will or will not be bound by the decision. Now, to be sure, it isn't in massive.
Well, actually, I believe it does call for it to be in bold face, or other prominent display. So we've made an effort under current law to say you've got to do this, and you've got to make a prominent disclosure to your members.
Yeah, thank you. Representative Walker.
Thank you, Chair Cruz. I've been looking through these pages trying mm-hmm. to find exactly who the independent review organization would be. Is that a body of persons? Is that the administrative central panel we have in Oregon? What is it?
They will be private entities. They're growing. They're happening around the country. They're being developed as more and more insurers and states require them. And they really are kind of, they are a panel themselves, although I suppose they're an entity that creates a panel, really. Do you want to say more?
Yes. Chairman Cruz, Representative Walker, I think a good example would be the entity that Providence already contracts with on a voluntary basis. It's called the Center for Health Dispute Resolution. It's a private entity that basically brings together a panel of physicians with expertise across the spectrum of medical care. And what the entity does is sort of the logistics of getting the cases to the specialist and seeing that they make their review and document it in a proper way. But it's basically a consortium of expert physicians who can review these cases. I'm not aware that any such consortium already exists in Oregon, so the department might well find themselves contracting with out-of-state entities, but they will in turn contract with medical experts across the country.
Follow up, please. Thank you, Chair Cruz. Then who will be paying for this? Will it be incumbent upon the patient who files the claim to pay for it, or will the insurer pay for it? How would that be paid for?
Chair Cruz, Representative Walker, the insurer will pay for it.
Thank you.
May I? Representative Morse, but the department will choose.
Exactly.
So the insurer has no way to influence.
Yes, Chair Cruz, Representative Morse said, I think there's two important things there. Number one, case by case, the department will assign one of their contracted review organizations to a case, and the insurer doesn't get to say, well, we want entity A. It's the luck of the draw. Secondly, the important thing about the department contracting is it gives the department a chance to say, to compare these contractors and say, gee, we think these four were pretty good and this fifth one wasn't so good, and they won't renew their contract.
Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee, we actually developed in conjunction with that, using this contracting process, a provision in the bill for every 2 years doing a reassessment of the contractors and whether you're getting good performance or whether, in fact, the department would choose, based on the feedback from the community, that to contract with different organizations. This is somewhat different from the way many states do it, in which case every entity that meets a set of criteria can can do these sorts of reviews, but the work group felt that it would be better to have a process of comparison and periodic reevaluation of the quality of the organizations. I should, going back to the right to sue portion of the discussion, you will note in the dash two amendments, page four, lines 12 through 15, the new language that the sanctions and remedies provided under the bill where an insurer fails to follow a review organization are in addition to, rather than substitute for, any other rights or remedies that may exist already. Section 16 and 17 are basically technical changes. Yeah. Go ahead.
Back on then page four, section 14. Tell me again then that the insurer, am I reading that the insurer doesn't like the decision, not bound by the decision of the review board?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mona Sanderson, if the insurer has declared at the outset in the in its plan that it will not be bound by them, then it has chosen to allow the any individual that may be aggrieved by that to sue. And so instead of binding themselves, they've opened themselves to suit. If I may, Mr. Chair, the reason that we chose this approach, which seems a little cumbersome, is that Oregon Constitution, as I understand it, forbids us to require anyone to waive their right to a jury trial. And by choosing to ask for the decision of an independent reviewer, your enrollee in a health plan will be essentially waiving any right that they might have to a jury to decide the case. And if an insurer chooses to put in its contract that it will be bounded, similarly has given up that right to a jury trial. But we believe that we need to allow for the possibility that the insurer does not want to make that waiver. And so we've given these options.
So, and again, this review board, the insurer, do they have any input as to who will comprise that review board? I mean,
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, they have one way in which they can influence that. The department will make a selection, random selection, and if the first selection that the department makes is not acceptable to the insurer will say, I don't want that one. Then they got to take whoever the department selects second.
And the insurer is okay with it. Okay.
That was a compromise.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, if I may, I guess I would try to summarize this this way, that all insurers will be required to have an external review process because state law can require that of insurers. What state law can't do is compel an insurer to waive its rights to a jury trial. So what we did is try to finesse this. We said, look, if insurers, you're willing to waive those rights and be bound, great. Then you can't be sued as long as you comply. You can't be sued. But if you want to take your chances in court, well, then you can be sued if you don't follow an external review decision.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I agree with that, although I would not say that you cannot be sued. I would say this bill doesn't create a right to sue. But if something else gives you a right to sue, be it federal law, be it something else, then that we're not addressing. But we don't create a right to sue. sue unless you've elected not to be
sued. Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Does this bill somewhere specify what the measure of damages is in such a suit? And if so, what is it?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it simply says that the damages are your losses resulting from the adverse decision. So that would be your losses from the failure to provide the service.
Is there any provision for attorney fees?
There is none.
Okay. Thank you.
May I? Representative Mosa.
No punitive damages.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the bill does not specifically allow punitive damages.
May I ask one more? Yeah. This is really interesting, and I think it's great first blush. Do other states have something similar? Did you borrow from other states in putting this together, or is this just our own creation?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'll take a pass at that. Lynn Marie may, too. I would say about half the states have one or more pieces of these kinds of patient protections. And we did take a look at what was out there, and we tried to use that as a starting point. But I would say the work group and the consensus process pretty much customized this to Oregon. But I'd say again, we're sort of in the mainstream of a lot of states in addressing these issues.
Representative Barnhart.
I have a follow-up to the follow-up, if I may. I guess I need to back up one more step. In the hearings process, what would be the measure? I'm not even sure I'm using the right language now.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of an award could you get? Would it simply be the cost of the procedures? Could it also include the damages that resulted from the fact that the procedures were not conducted in a timely fashion because of the denial, or what, or something else?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Barnhart, I would understand it to be the latter. That is, not only the cost of the procedure, but what the compensation for the consequences of failure to get the procedure in a timely fashion.
And if I may follow up, is there a measure then of the value of the death of the insured, or something else, some other way of those kinds of damages, pain and suffering, or other things of that sort? Or are we dealing completely with medical costs?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Barnhart, I am somewhat reluctant to expound beyond the language of the bill, although Section
13.2.
Damages arise. The insurer is responsible for damages arising from an adverse decision by the insurer. I think that's broad language. I would suggest to you, Representative Barnhart, which could include compensation for death. But I have to tell you that we're really working on the words of the of the bill, and we did not have a great deal of discussion about what all those elements would be.
I'm sorry, I can't find that.
On page 13 of your Hand and Gross bill,
yes.
Section 13 is
yes.
The section she's
subsection 2 of
section 13.
And mine reads, the decision of an independent review organization is admissible in any legal proceeding involving the insurer. And that's not what she read. So I must have something.
Okay,
you have a Hand and Gross version of the bill.
That section was deleted that she read in the amendment.
In the dash, I'm assuming the amendment is making the dash.
Every number, that piece of it.
Okay.
I think she's at the top of page 14, actually. Subsection 3 of the Hand and Gross.
Didn't you say the sanctions under subsection 1 of this section and the remedies under subsection 2 of this section are in addition to and not in lieu of other sanctions? Rights and remedies?
Yes, but the specification of damages comes before that. It starts with if an insurer states in a plan.
But that's been eliminated in the dash.
Oh, that's been moved to 14, hasn't it?
Yes.
To 14. Okay. Yeah.
No, that doesn't cover it either.
I wonder if it was supposed to be moved. Did it not reappear? Let's see.
Yeah, look at the
dash.
Page 4 of the dash.
My dash 2 shows it as section 14 sub 1.
Mm-hmm. Right. Okay, there it is. Yeah.
And the key phrase is...
Right.
For damages arising from an adverse decision. And so I think what we can say is that those damages have not been described as to their extent.
Nothing in the bill about that.
Right. They've not been limited nor specified.
Okay, so if this bill passes as it's written, there will be a lawsuit about what damages means someplace along the line. One presumes.
Chair, Representative Barnhart, there could certainly be a discussion of what the extent of those damages are, yes.
That's simply not defined in the bill, then, is that right? Okay, thank you.
Really, we've discussed the significant content of the bill. As we noted earlier, Section 15 is the language that describes what the content of the plan is and the notice that must be given to enrollees about their rights under the bill. Section 16 and 17 are really technical materials to integrate these provisions into current law. Section 18 provides that the Act becomes operative July 1 of 2002. Section 19 allows the department to go ahead with rulemaking and other activity necessary to be ready for the full operational bill to become operative mid 2002. So unless the committee has further questions,
any other questions?
That concludes my comments.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay. Next, Wendy, I don't even want to try your last name. Sorry, it's late. Please. The northern area.
Good afternoon, and thank you all for your patience in being here this long. My name is Wendy Van Elverdeen. I'm the Associate Director of the Oregon Health Action Campaign, and I also provide staffing to the Campaign for Patients' Rights. Because I've given you written testimony, I'm going to not say much more, but we just wanted to make sure that we were on record as saying we're supportive of this bill, and thank you very much for hearing us.
Hi, I'm Jim Davis. Chair of the Campaign for Patient Rights, and also here representing the State Council of Senior Citizens and United Seniors of Oregon. We want to express our very strong support for 3040, and of course we've been very actively involved in this whole process. The Campaign for Patient Rights was started in 1996, and our purpose was to bring about some major changes in patient protections for managed health care patients in the state of Oregon. We had the opportunity to be very actively involved in the 1997 Patient Protection Act, and we came back last session with a series of bills that we thought would take us to step two. And amongst those bills were things such as external review, right to sue, referrals to specialists, access to non-formulary drugs, continuity of care, network adequacy type of issues. They didn't really go anywhere, and there was great frustration among advocates. And what happened then is we joined together with the AFL-CIO, our coalition of about 35 groups joined together with the AFL-CIO. And we began our work on a series of statewide ballot measures that we would have put on the ballot in the year 2000. Shortly after that, we had the opportunity, representatives of Campaign for Patient Rights and the AFL-CIO, to begin to meet with very high-ranking officials within the major health plans, the CEOs and some of their major representatives. And out of those discussions then came our agreement to pull back on the initiative, and then came the formation of the governor's patient protection work group. And we then spent about six, 7 months working together with representatives of the industry and consumers and purchasers to come up with the bill you see before you. So a lot of long and hard hours, and so we think that this is really the best that we can get out of this process, and we're very pleased with this bill. Enough has been said about this, but we do want to just to make a few comments that I think, you know, things such as external review, it really allows the consumer to move beyond an internal grievance process and get an independent review of the plan's decision, particularly to deny, reduce, or terminate care for an enrollee. We feel that it is a fair, impartial, and cost-effective way of expediting difficult disputes. Continuity of care allows for the continuation of care with a particular doctor, and what we're finding is a sudden involuntary switch to another doctor in the middle of an active course of treatment oftentimes can cause severe medical and psychological repercussions. You look at ongoing referrals to specialists, and it provides a simpler and more effective process to particularly those people dealing with chronic illness. It removes what has been a very significant barrier, we feel, for chronically ill patients who have had to go back to their primary care physician every time they wanted to see a specialist. And then we're pleased with the network adequacy provisions, and the potential for an advisory group and the development of administrative rules around this that report to have uniform indicators around reporting the scope and adequacy of provider networks. So very pleased with what has come out of this process. We strongly support it. It's been a painstaking process. We strongly urge you to vote yes on the amended version of House Bill 3040 as supported by the Governor's Patient Protection Work Group. And we thank you for this opportunity.
Would you be willing to take on the workers' comp issue as soon as we get through this?
Oh, no problem. That'll be an easy one.
That will not be in this committee.
I'm Ellen Lowe, and I should note that I participated in the patient protection work group without portfolio. It was at a time when I really was retired. I did bring to the group, however, though, my background as a consumer member of Oregon's Health Services Commission and also the Insurance Pool Governing Board. And I also brought my very strong belief that the health status of Oregonians really will be served by having a healthy system of coordinated health care. And confidence in the system is so important to the effectiveness of any medical treatment. And so what I would just add is that I think what this bill really contributes to the health of Oregonians is a framework that should give them every confidence that they're going to get effective, timely care. And I really encourage your support of this legislation and of its implementation. Thank you so very much.
Thank you all very much. Okay, not wanting anybody to be last, I'm going to call Peggy Annette and Phil Griffin up together, so neither one has to be last. know. So Phil, why don't you go first?
I guess I am black.
So you are black. Right, yeah.
But you're not off the table.
Chairman Cruz, committee members, my name is Phil Griffin. I chair the Oregon Healthcare Purchasers Coalition, and actually I like being cleanup on this. I think you know, what you've seen is just a really, really very small piece of all the deliberation that went on over 8 months at a time. When we got into some of the legal implications and what kind of an award might be given, we went through that kind of detail on every piece of this legislation, and it really was a very diverse group. So there wasn't silence on any of these issues, and we don't think we left any stone unturned. And as a result of that, the coalition, which represents about 38 employers, mostly medium-sized to large employers, about 400,000 covered lives, there was a unanimous decision by the board to approve this bill, because it really covers in good balance all of the measures that you see spelled out here. There was a concern about cost, what this would do to health plans, and how much of that was going to get passed on to employers. There was a concern about the access that our employees would have, and kind of a fair due process in case they disagreed with what kind of treatment they got. But it covered the whole gamut. And so I think you've just seen a very short piece of what went on for 8 months. And I really, really urge you to support this bill, because there was an awful lot of deliberation and a lot of diversity that came to this conclusion. So thank you.
Mr. Chair, excuse me, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Peggy Annett, and I'm representing the Health Insurance Association of America. And I have to explain that that we were not part of the work group, and so what I am bringing as the last speaker here are some concerns with regard to the bill. I will say that my understanding of the bill as drafted is that the participants in the work group agreed that that so long as the concepts remained intact, they would stay on the bill. If there were deviations, significant policy deviations, they would no longer support the bill. I have one policy issue, and then I have technical issues that I wanted to raise with regard to the language. The policy issue is the scope of the application in terms of the definition of managed care, and that is that it includes preferred provider organizations. These plans actually allow an individual choice of the provider. For these reasons, that HIA believes that a PPO or a point of service type of plan also should not be included in the scope of managed care as defined. Moving on to some of the other issues in the bill, I believe that in terms of the definition of a grievance, in terms of who can file one of these appeals, it should be the enrollee or a member of the enrollee's family, as opposed to being as open-ended as it is now stated in there. In the section that deals with continuity of care, there are two provisions in there. One says that, in essence, what it requires is that a carrier is to notify an enrollee in the event that the contractual relationship between the insured and the enrollee, or the insured and the provider, terminates. There's a provision in there that says that the insurer shall notify the enrollee when the insurer should reasonably know that there is a relationship between a provider and an insured. We find that to be too vague, given the multiplicity of arrangements that a person could have. We believe that the insured should only be required to notify the enrollee in the event that they know that there is an existing relationship. With regard to the referrals to specialists, this is kind of an interesting provision, in that these are standing referrals, but unlike the section on continuity of care, there are no references in there that necessarily make it explicit that that there is a medically necessary circumstances associated with it. It is difficult to tell whether or not the insurer will be allowed to set conditions that would make this these standing referrals for medically necessary treatment for when a person is undergoing a specific course of treatment. Regarding the external review, we also believe that the time frame in there should be shortened from 6 months to 3 months, thinking that that is in the interest of the insured as well as the insurers in terms of resolving those kinds of outstanding issues as soon as possible. There's another issue in there that relates to the external review organization, which there's a current provision in there that says the external review organizations will provide synopses of the cases that they review. There is a firm concern on the part of HIAA that there are privacy issues associated with this and that the synopsis route is not the appropriate way to go. I believe that it is more important to track these by type of grievance and number of grievances. And I do realize that in the amendments they did include language that relates to privacy, but given the nature of the cases that would likely come before external review organization under for experimental treatments, it would be very difficult, in our opinion, to assure that those cases were in fact disguised in terms of not knowing who is affected. And then there's one minor technical recommendation with regard to the language in the bill, and that deals with the time frames that are in there, and we would just recommend that the bill be reviewed and have the references to days correspond to the DCBS current standards, and they consistently refer to calendar days. And as the bill is presently written, it is open-ended in that regard. And I should also say that HIA is supportive of the external review process, is supportive of patient protection in general. The concern relates about the ambiguities that can exist, and particularly when you get into areas that are as complicated as the issues that have been laid out, I think it is extremely prudent to be sure that there is a clear and firm understanding of what these provisions actually require and how they will be interpreted. Thank you.
Questions?
Mr. Chair, how would these concerns be relayed to the group that's worked on this, just to see if there were any, if they felt, if it could be that all of these concerns have already been discussed and they still came up out with what we had. Is there any way to get some feedback regarding her issues or the Health Insurance Association of America issues?
Phil Griffin, Chairman Cruz, and Representative Moines Anderson?
Monis Anderson.
Monis Anderson, sorry. This is the first that I've heard about this. I'm not sure that I'm not the only one who has not heard about it on the committee. And obviously, we would want to take a look at what she's presented and, you know, take a look and see if there's any other stones that apparently we may not have turned over. So we'll have an opportunity to do that. I know that Lynn Marie was taking notes, and is there something that you'd like to add?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, a number of the points that Ms. Annett raised are things that we did discuss, and so I could probably, if it was helpful, give you insight into our thinking. Others are not, and my impression is that to the extent there are things like calendar days and ordinary days, that's something we could deal with on the Senate side if it seemed appropriate. I guess that would be my suggestion about how we proceed.
Representative Cromwell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just curious, Ms. Annett, in your testimony you said that HIA was not part of the work group that developed the proposal, meaning that basically you weren't at the table. I'm just curious as to why you weren't at the table.
Representative Cruz, Representative Crummell, the reason was that there was a set number of entities that were invited to participate, and HIAA was not one of those entities. The reason was they wanted to keep the group small.
Can I follow up, Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
I'm just curious in how much of the insurance market share does HIAA have?
It is not as significant in terms of the group market, but in terms of the individual market, HIAA members are the third largest provider of individual coverage in the state.
I'm just following up on
on Representative Crumble's question, so who are the providers of these insurance?
It would include Mutual of Omaha, Aetna, John Alden Insurance, a variety of carriers like that.
Thank you.
In other words, Mr. Chair, the really big, big guns we had at the table, is that what we...
There's Representative Kremel and members of the committee, the situation in Oregon in terms of the split in the market, the domestic carriers by and large cover the group market, the small group and large group. That is not the case with regard to the individual market, as I just mentioned. And if we think that there are issues associated with healthcare costs in the group market, they are multiplied over and over and over again in the individual market, and that is why these issues are of significant concern to us.
Senator Grubb, Ms. Annette, while you weren't a member of the groups, did you at any time make an effort to have these concerns presented to the group?
I had raised concerns, but basically the process was to feed them into, you know, through the carriers. And so what I did in terms of this process was to choose, knowing that there would be public testimony on this to do this. And in terms of the amendments, for example, that you're looking at today, just got a copy of those yesterday.
Any other questions?
You got a question? Oh, you're just poking fun at him. Okay.
Thank you very much. Yeah, I'm going to close a public hearing on House Bill 3040. If there are any concerns, there will be time to address them between here and those building rooms next door, and I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 3040.
Mr. Chair?
I would move that we move House Bill 3040 to the...
We need the dash twos.
That we need to move the dash twos. I would move the dash twos.
Representative Morissette has moved the dash twos to House Bill 3040. Are there any objections? Hearing so ordered.
Do the dash twos include the dash ones?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Crummell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll move House Bill 3040 as amended. We're going to the floor, right?
Yep.
House Bill 3040 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Crummell has moved House Bill 3040 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to thank the people who worked very hard on this bill for quite a while. I think it's obvious to everyone that this is not the sort of bill that a legislative committee could develop because of the nature of a legislative committee and the need to get input on an ongoing basis over a period of time from all of the players in the process. And the give and take that this sort of bill requires. And you know, there are places in the bill that I could criticize, and there are other places that I could like a lot. But the fact is that you've come up with a bill which at least gives us the first iteration of a process that will protect patients perhaps better than they have been in the past, at least give them some more assurance than they've had in the past, and also give the health insurance companies a reasonable chance to do their job in a way that they consider best. As a result of that, and in review of with the process, I'm going to support the bill in hopes that it will provide us with an improvement over the existing system. I especially want to thank those who worked so hard on it, because I think that you've done a good job in that process.
I would echo that many times over.
Clerk will call the roll.
Representative
Walker?
Yes.
Representative Kamei?
Yes.
Representative Kummel?
Aye.
Representative Gerard?
Aye.
Representative Montana?
Aye.
Representative Barnhart?
Aye.
Chair Cruz?
Aye. House Bill 34, having received the required majority, is declared passed, and because I just discovered today that I'm the only Republican to sign on to the darn thing, I'll carry it. And
all right.
I'll close the public hearing on 3040, and colleagues, hang with me for, or the work session on 3040. Hang with me for a minute. I'm going to reopen the work session on 2520. We did find out that we are not messing with the audit. For those who weren't here, we have that testimony from LC. And so I would entertain a motion to move the bill.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Do we have we already attached all of the amendments that need to be attached? The dash twos and let's see, the dash two include the dash one, I believe.
Yes.
And so have we attached those yet?
Just in case we didn't, let's reattach them if we have.
Okay, Mr. Chair, I would move the dash two amendments to House Bill 2520.
Representative Cromwell has moved the dash two amendments 2520. Is there any objections? Hearing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair, I'll move House Bill 2520 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Cromwell has moved House Bill 2520 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Clerk, call the roll.
Representative Walker?
Yes.
Representative
Clemay?
Yes.
Representative
Hummel?
Aye.
Representative
Morrison?
Aye.
Representative Gerard?
Aye.
Representative Montanson?
Aye.
Representative Barnhart?
Aye.
Chair Cruz?
Aye. House Bill 2520, having received the required majority, is declared passed. Representative Gerard will carry. I'll close the work session on 2520 and adjourn. Thank you.
Hey.